This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Blaine Harden, was the Washington Post bureau chief in sub-Saharan Africa from 1985 to 1989. He arrived at the height of the Ethiopian famine. One of the first people he interviewed was an Ethiopian woman whose child had just died of starvation. As they spoke, he noticed her fingertips were falling off, a condition of leprosy. Harden would encounter many other scenes of suffering during his 4 years in Africa, and he learned of the dire condition of the continent. The population growth is high and food production low. Central and East Africa are plagued with AIDS. The rainforests and the animal population are being destroyed. Civil wars have created the world's largest refugee problem. But Harden doesn't believe the continent is doomed. Blaine Harden has written a book about sub-Saharan Africa called Africa, Dispatches from a Fragile Continent. He writes that after coming to know the continent, he found himself more and more intolerant of a soft-focused stereotype of Africa.
Well, it's the stereotype that Africa should be viewed through the lenses of colonialism, that it should be a place where people can buy some Banana Republic clothes and go and look at game and think that this is what Africa should be, is now and should be forever. I think Nigeria is more typical of what Africa is and will be becoming. The game, unfortunately, will probably have to go the way of the American buffalo, because there are lots of people in Africa. The population is growing faster than any population has ever grown in the history of the world. There are 600 million plus now. That will double in 20 years. And those who look at Africa and try to understand it are going to have to realize that Africa is going to be a place where the problems are political and about people and not about miles and miles of bloody Africa and Maasai warriors in the tall grass.
But Maasai warriors are people, and the issues that affect them are partly political.
Well, it's true, but it's the idea that the continent should conform to stereotypes rather than become what it is becoming, which is a slowly modernizing region of the world.
Let's talk about some of the political problems facing African countries now. You describe some of the sub-Saharan countries as having a kleptocratic state. Is this a new word?
It's a word that's been coined by political scientists who've been studying Africa for the past 30 years. What it means is that African leaders, by and large, in the 45 countries of sub-Saharan Africa, have very little political legitimacy other than the legitimacy they can buy or coerce. They, by and large, are not elected. They do not serve terms that are limited by law. There's no two-term rule in any country. In fact, there's never been an African leader who's been voted out by his constituents. They buy loyalty by trying to rig deals that give them a certain percentage of all the businesses in their country, and then they use that to buy loyalty from members of their own family, first of all, then their tribe, and then from allies. The most creative of these big men is probably Mobutu in Zaire, and he has managed to create the kleptocratic state in which everyone expects the system to work based on graft. For example, a new minister, say in transportation, will not look to building roads or building bridges. He will look to getting contracts for roads or bridges that give him the highest kickback potential in the least amount of time, because he knows that the bridge or the road is likely not to be constructed, and he also knows that he's not likely to hold his job for very long. So the idea is to get what you can as quickly as possible. And this is what government amounts to in Zaire.
Well, you were exposed to corruption just traveling around. What are some examples of the types of corruption you had to put up with?
Well, I guess the best example is when I was planning to take a boat trip on the Zaire River from the interior out to the capital. And my cholera vaccination had expired, and I went to the official in Kisangani who was in charge of looking at cholera, and he looked at me and shook his head, and then after a while he said, perhaps we have a solution. And he pulled out of his drawer a rubber stamp, which was my vaccination against cholera, and I just had to give him some money. It wasn't a whole lot by American standards. It was $4 or $5, I think.
So did he give you a vaccination or just a rubber stamp?
No, he stamped my passport in such a way that I was vaccinated against cholera.
Were you worried that you'd get cholera, or is the whole need for the vaccination in the first place just to have another reason to pay people off?
Well, yes, that's true. Cholera vaccinations don't work by and large, and most countries in Africa do not require them anymore. And it's just sort of an elaborate farce, which is only played in Zaire. It was the only time that ever happened, actually.
My guest is reporter Blaine Harden, and he was the bureau chief for the Washington Post in sub-Saharan Africa from 1985 to 1989, and he's just written a book called Africa, Dispatches from a Fragile Continent. Tell us what you think the typical traits are of the big man, the kind of leader who you think has become typical in sub-Saharan Africa.
Almost all of the 45 leaders in the 45 countries of sub-Saharan Africa, the leaders carry similar traits. They aren't elected, first of all, and if they were to submit to elections, they would be likely to lose. They go to church. Their every pronouncement is on the front page of the papers in the countries that they control. As in Kenya, the first words that one hears when watching the evening news is, "Today, His Excellency the President Daniel Arap Moi said." This happens day after day, year after year. The leaders pretend to believe in whatever philosophy the donors who have the most money are espousing. For example, in Zaire, Mobutu will say that he's a free marketeer in order to get money from the World Bank and the IMF and the United States government. In other countries, such as Ethiopia, Mengistu Haile Mariam will profess to be a communist or a Marxist in order to get arms to fight against his rebels in the north. It's a rather cynical manipulation, and the whole idea is to hold on to power.
You also say that the big man is usually the richest man in the country with his picture on all the money.
Picture on the money, and it's important that he is the richest man, but it's even more important that he is known to be the richest man, because wealth in sub-Saharan Africa, in the absence of law, in the absence of courts, in the absence of legislatures, is power per se. Any money that is not controlled by the big man is dissidence.
Can we look at Samuel Doe, the late Samuel Doe of Liberia, who was just killed off? Where does he fit in your picture of the big man?
Well, he's
or did the, he fit in? Yeah.
Yeah, he was the top of the pile of the bad guys. And what's particularly interesting about Liberia is that Liberia is, by and large, an American colony. It was founded by freed American slaves. It's the only country in Africa where the people speak with an inflection that somehow sounds American. They admire America there. They follow it very closely. Their political system is designed to be an imitation. Samuel Kenyon Doe came to power in 1980 by leading a band of soldiers, and they went upstairs and eviscerated the sitting president at the time, while Samuel Kenyon Doe actually didn't go inside. He hid in the bushes. But he later took over control of the country. He began a 10-year process of destroying the country. But what's interesting to note is that during the first 5 years, he sweet-talked the U.S. government into believing that he would turn over power after a free and fair election. He promised this to the ambassador. He watched tapes of President Ronald Reagan speaking so that he could learn to speak a more presentable brand of English. And he promised that he would step down. I was there for the election in 1985. And the first time that Liberians ever had a chance to vote in such a free way. And they came out and voted in high numbers, and they voted against Samuel Kenyon Doe. In the counting of the election, ballots were simply burned on the edge of town, and Doe made up the count. There were American diplomats who observed it, who wrote to Washington and said this was an elaborate farce, we should not support him. But the Reagan administration at the time did not follow the advice of the State Department people who were there on hand, as well as the journalists who were there, calling it a sort of sick joke. And so Doe was confirmed as president. A few months later, there was an attempted coup. Doe and Doe's soldiers, the members of his Kron tribe, began a series of tribal retaliations against those who were involved in the coup. And Liberia suddenly had a problem that it did not have before, which was tribal hatred and a desire for revenge. What's happened in the past 10 months in Liberia is sort of the bitter fruit of the past 10 years. And I think it's fair to say that the United States government is to blame in part. If it would have insisted that Doe step down after this election was stolen, as it insisted that Marcos step down about the same time, Doe probably would have not had a chance to survive. The U.S. at the time was giving Liberia more money per capita than to any country in sub-Saharan Africa and more than just about any country in the world. And they were buying a monster.
When you reported on the Liberian election in 1985, did you report that Samuel Doe had stolen the election? Did you put it that bluntly?
Yes, I was very blunt. But it did not seem to affect the judgment of the people in Washington. There was really no doubt about what happened. But as has happened many times in Africa, the people in Washington sometimes prefer to go with the bad guy they know than the bad guy that they don't know. I was told by ambassadors there in as late as 89 that Doe promised a democratic exercise, and that's what he gave us, and so we must stick with him.
What do you see ahead for the future of Liberia?
It's a very dark future, I think. There is, in effect, no government right now. There's a West African peacekeeping force in there that is beginning to fight against Charles Johnson, the rebel leader. It could turn into a protracted civil war. The country's infrastructure has been largely destroyed by the fighting. More than 500,000 people are dislocated, outside of the country now. It's a tragic situation that need not have happened if the statecraft of the United States had been a little more moral, a little sharper. In fact, I think the lesson from Liberia that the U.S. government learned was to, if they're going to supervise an election, they have to withdraw support for the person who loses afterwards. And I think this lesson was learned with Marcos and with Noriega, in fact.
Why do you think the countries of sub-Saharan Africa have such a poor record of leadership?
I think it's because of the fundamentally fictional nature of the nations. The colonial juggernaut that came into black Africa in the 1880s and 1890s came in with an incredible sense of its own superiority. It imposed artificial boundaries on Africa, sort of an artificial overlay was pressed onto the continent. And the way the states worked were there was top-down management, and they were designed to extract mineral wealth and agricultural wealth and to keep people quiet. In late 1950s, early 1960s, the colonialists packed up and left for a variety of reasons. But what they left were these artificial states which had a legacy of being run from the top down. A new elite, a black elite, came in and took over the states and ran them in basically the same way. They didn't run them as efficiently, but they used the same top-down methods. And the only means that were left to the new elite to control their nations, to keep them together, were coercion and bribery. If they would have gone along with the constitutions that were written at the time, which would have allowed free elections, which would have allowed freedom of choice, the countries probably would have dissolved because the people did not believe in them. So people wrote constitutions that guaranteed free elections, that guaranteed courts, that guaranteed education, and they ignored them. And they went to work buying loyalty or coercing it.
You've described tribalism as the fundamental political illness of modern Africa. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, I think it's the fundamental political reality of Africa. And what black Africa governments, citizens need to do is they need to switch their allegiance from their tribe to their nation, from their family to themselves and to a more westernized standard of success. That is the way that other developing countries have moved up in terms of per capita income and the other indices of progress in the past 20 years. However, there's one important thing to say about tribalism and the family extended family, is that in the absence of government, which is pretty much the state of affairs all across Black Africa, the tribe and the family are essentials in as a sort of homegrown social welfare network. I talked to a professor of economics professor at the University of Nairobi. He had a corn crop coming in around Lake Victoria. He couldn't go, but he knew that members of his family and member of his Luo tribe would get in that corn crop for him, and because his pay was low at the university, he needed it to eat and sell to other people. And that is the kind of system that works now in lieu of government. If government starts to build institutions like legislatures, like courts, like agricultural extension services that really work and serve people, then these older governing entities such as tribes and families will diminish in importance as they have in the rest of the developing world.
Are you projecting cultural Western cultural values onto Africa when you suggest that they loosen tribal ties?
I guess in a certain way I am, but I'm doing that based on having spent a lot of time talking to a lot of Africans about what they see has to happen to the continent for it to fit into the modern world. And Africa really has no choice. It cannot be a place, as I said earlier, of where there are zebras running around everywhere, and people have to make a living, particularly when their population doubles every 20 years. They have to have governments and corporations and ways of producing wealth to handle all these people. The collapse of the evolution away from tribalism as the most important governing factor is part of what every educated African wants to see. They feel, I think, that it is absolutely necessary to have loyalties to law rather than to tribal values, because then you have a level playing field for business, for achievement in art, in everything. There are certain tribal quotas that must be met in almost every African country, regardless of actual capabilities. This holds Africa back. And I've been told by really thousands of Africans that the process is moving too slowly because governments do not work. Governments afflict rather than govern, so people have to fall back on what they know and what they know will work to a certain extent, which is their extended family and their tribe.
My guest is reporter Blaine Harden, and he was the bureau chief for the Washington Post in sub-Saharan Africa from 1985 to 89. He's written a new book called Africa, Dispatches from a Fragile Continent. Well, you've really painted such a grim picture. You know, you've criticized tribalism, you've criticized the government, you've criticized foreign aid. It seems like, well, where do you turn? You know, what do you look for a solution?
Well, I think what you look for a solution is what's happening in Nigeria. Nigeria is the hopeful part of my book, and it's the most important country, I think, to understand in Africa because it's the biggest and it's the richest. Nigeria ropes together the Yoruba, the Hausa Fulani, and the Igbo. They were traditional strangers and enemies to each other for centuries. They did not get along well in Nigeria. They still do not get along that well. And they had a terrible war in which more than 1 million people lost their lives in the late 60s. And what that war did is it taught the Nigerians that war is no solution. It causes too much suffering. It was a cathartic experience. And after the war, Nigeria was lucky enough to benefit from $100 billion in oil profits. That was squandered, unfortunately. But in the process, they learned that government cannot control the wealth of a people because the government will waste it. And what's happening now in Nigeria is they're privatizing the major industries. Most significantly, they're privatizing the petroleum industry. There are hundreds of thousands of Nigerians who benefited from the oil boom to get technical educations in the United States and in other Western countries. Right now, the current leadership is a military dictatorship in a way, but it is moving systematically towards democratic elections in a couple years. The leader's name is Ibrahim Baba Ngita, and he has promised free and fair elections, and if he does not deliver them, he will be overthrown. Most importantly, the Nigerians have an intolerance for dictators that I think is unique on the continent. They simply will not tolerate a man who denies them their basic rights. When generals in the past have promised elections and then delayed them, they were quickly overthrown. I think that Nigeria is building a civil society, which the rest of Africa doesn't have.
You, from 1985 to 89, were the bureau chief for the Washington Post in sub-Saharan Africa. And since then, you've been based in Eastern Europe. You're in Poland now. What's it like to go from one part of the world to another part of the world and be equally unfamiliar with both when you get there? I often wonder why reporters don't stay in one place longer. It seems pretty common for newspapers to move foreign correspondents from one country to another after a few years. Do you think that there are advantages in moving like that?
Well, there are some advantages. Let me talk about the disadvantages first. It's extremely difficult, and it's extremely disorienting. And I don't recommend it to any sane person to do it, particularly if you have to write about it with an expertise you may not have, which is what correspondents do for big newspapers. They simply have to learn while they run around. It's not pleasant. However, if you spend too long in any region of the world, I think you lose your awe at its difference compared to American culture. And what I try to do in writing about Africa or Eastern Europe is to give a sense of place, more important than anything else, that this is a different part of the world and this is what it looks and smells like. And unless that is in the stories, it's very hard to get readers other than policy analysts to look at your stories. Americans are distracted, they're busy, and for my money, the only way to get them to read, to learn, is to amaze and delight them with the difference with the different sights and sounds of different parts of the world.
Still, though, that lack of knowledge when a reporter gets to a place, do you ever look back at your early pieces and think, gee, I was really naive then?
Yes, particularly in Nigeria. Nigeria is for a Westerner going to Nigeria, it's really dirty and loud and smelly. And I wrote a piece about Lagos, which the Washington Post loved and put on the front page, which was, you know, young reporter goes to Lagos and is appalled and tries to make it funny. Over the next 4 years, I went there 5 more times, and I tried to understand the place. And it's still incredibly ugly and smelly, but there is an energy and a sense of progress in that country that is underneath all of those superficially miserable things. And that does take time to discover. And 4 or 5 years, luckily, is how long most of us stay in our posts. And by the end, we're writing good things.
Well, I want to thank you for talking with us about Africa. Thank you.
Thank you.
My guest has been Blaine Harden, and his new book about Africa is called Africa, Dispatches from a Fragile Continent. He's now based in Eastern Europe. He's the bureau chief there for the Washington Post.